Smithsonian Folkways is releasing Jazz, the Smithsonian Anthology, a 6-CD set, 7 years in the making, that seeks to trace the evolution of jazz. And joining me now to discuss it are John Edward Hasse, historian, pianist, author, and composer, Dan Morgenstern, director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University, and Richard James Burgess, director of marketing and sales for the Smithsonian Folkways label. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Richard, when did you decide to make a new Smithsonian Jazz Anthology? Was it 7 years ago?
Or? It was actually longer ago than that. I first started at the Smithsonian almost 10 years ago, and as soon as I got there, I wanted to know what had happened to the old Smithsonian collection of classic jazz.
Now, that was called collection. This is called anthology. Is there any distinction you're making there, or is it just didn't want to confuse the two?
No, there are a couple of distinctions, actually. One is that in the museum world, collection means something different, and two is we wanted to retire the name in some ways because it was Martin Williams' collection, and we felt that was something he did, and he did it on his own, and it was kind of almost a respectful thing, I would say. And then thirdly, we polled all the various advisors about it and asked them whether we should call it a collection, whether we should call it classic anthology, and so on and so forth. And almost overwhelmingly, everybody favored calling it an anthology.
Now, the Martin Williams collection was great, but it went out of print. Why?
Well, for a number of reasons. One is that they kind of seemed to keep closing units behind him. So he worked for the Division of Performing Arts initially, and then that morphed into Smithsonian Recordings, which was part of Smithsonian Publications. And somehow these units kept getting closed, and that's why it went out of print ultimately. But it hadn't been updated for some time. It was updated, and it was originally put out in 73, updated in 87, and reissued again in 97. But then it really just fell out of print.
Well, there have been any number of other compilations in recent years, and I'm sure, Richard, you were thinking about that when, like the Ken Burns PBS documentary series CDs that accompanied it?
Sure. Well, I mean, we were aware of everything else that had been out, but there hadn't been a large collection like this that had been out for a while. Plus, we were getting a lot of feedback from educators that they really wanted something really attuned to the jazz appreciation, jazz history courses.
Now, Dan, I remember one of the first LPs I ever bought was a Folkways record, a mix of root recordings from Africa, the South, and other sources of jazz. So is that where the Folkways connection comes in here?
Well, that was Fred Ramsey's collection, and it was kind of interesting because that was during the days when Folkways was run by the inimitable Mo Ash. And a lot of the stuff was actually, you know, in a sense, it was bootlegged because it was taken off major labels without, you know, whatever. But it was a very interesting compilation.
I'm not telling.
Actually, that was actually, you're right, that was actually the first one of this kind, the attempt to, you know, to show the whole scope of the music.
Well, some years ago, I tried to do a history of jazz on another radio station. And I had Eddie Bearfield, who went back to the old days, and I played a James Reese Europe record, and he said, "That's not jazz." And that was he said, because there's no improvisation. But the history of jazz varies depending on who's telling the story, and some start with things like that because it was the early music that led to jazz.
Well, it depends on how you know, defining jazz is very problematic, and there are 100 different definitions. Yeah. But what we did in this case was to kick off with Maple Leaf Rag, which may not be jazz, but it's an emblematic
Scotch
item
album
in the history of African American music. So it had to be there.
But I was surprised that you didn't play the Scott Joplin version. Instead, you have a modern recording.
Well, Dick Hyman's recording, which is the one we used, is really letter perfect as to what Joplin put on paper. And Joplin's own, which, by the way, we're not 100% sure that it's really by Joplin.
It's a piano roll,
which is a mechanical system that does not give you all the, you know, it doesn't properly represent the piano.
Well, Jelly Roll Morton claimed that he invented jazz, John. Can anybody really be given credit for that?
Not really. I mean, he had some credence to his – there was some credence to his claim because long before jazz made it onto record, he was evidently taking rags and improvising, embellishing, swinging the music. But you can't say one person invented the music.
Well, if I had to credit anybody, it would be the man we opened with, Louis Armstrong, because even though there was already jazz and there was the word jazz, he's the guy who kind of created the form that has existed ever since, don't you think?
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Louis is the one who he really wrote the book. I mean, before Louis, there were fine musicians and there was very interesting music, but he took it to another level, and he was tremendously influential.
Well, I'm sure everybody asks you the same question: how do you determine what to include in something like this? Obviously, you could have put out a 50 CD collection and people would complain that you left out this track or that track.
We could have. You know, I mean, it's all credit to John and Dan, Alan Shipton, Jose Bowen, and David Baker.
And then you consulted 47 others?
No, 42 others, actually. But they were advisory people that actually basically fed us ideas at the beginning. But it was really the five people on the executive selection committee that made all the final choices and really shaped the set. And I'm incredibly grateful to the five of them. But, you know, there were three long meetings. We talk about that in the notes in New York City, consecutive Januaries during the IAJE. I always like to say maybe on the spiritual home of Birdland. It was right about there, isn't it, where we met?
Yes, not far away.
Not far, yeah. So, you know, I thought that was that was significant. But a lot of debate, a huge amount of debate. And not everybody, you know, it certainly wasn't unanimous, but it was very collegial, and we came to I was impressed by everybody's.
Well, very much thanks to you, because you really kept it on track. Because there's a tendency. We had one very long meeting.
Yeah.
Excuse me, which lasted from about 3 p.m. to 1 a.m.
Yeah.
And I think something squeezed through at the end there because everybody was.
Well, how do you do it? I mean, I could not pick one or two tracks by Louis Armstrong. You only have one Charlie Parker track here. Yeah. John Williams had a number of different ones to show us the changes. If you think of some of these musicians like John Coltrane or Miles Davis or Coleman Hawkins, their work changes so much over the course of their lives that no one track can really tell us their story.
That's a very good point. And perhaps but it was inevitable. Once it was decided that we were going up to the present or almost the present, the cutoff year is 2003. Mm-hmm. We could not accommodate something that is important and often overlooked, which is, as you said, that Coleman Hawkins developed from. We do have early Hawk in with Fletcher Henderson, mm-hmm. The Stampede. And then we have him twice. We have the famous Body and Soul. And we have him on a wonderful so-called, it's a group called the Chocolate Dandies. It's an ad hoc group. And with Roy Eldridge and Benny Carter, and there's a great Coleman Hawkins, a fast Coleman Hawkins.
But you could have had him with Thelonious Monk. You could have had him with Fats Navarro. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and that's Charlie Parker, by the way, there is only one under his name as leader, but he's also on a wonderful collaboration with Dizzy Gillespie called Sure Enough.
Right.
Well, then there were fights. There's an artist like Ahmad Jamal, favorite of Miles Davis, who didn't make the anthology, but someone like John Medeski, whose band Medeski, Martin, and Wood played with the jam band Fish, is included.
Right. Well, that's Dan's favorite topic, actually.
it was a controversial item. It wasn't my favorite, but it makes sense because it's contemporary. And they're good musicians.
And you want to show the way jazz has evolved over the years?
Right.
Can we say that the history of jazz, to some degree, is a reflection of the history of American popular music over the 20th century?
John?
Sure. It's an important part of the soundtrack of the American 20th century. And you had increasing rhythmic activity. You had increasing experimentation. You had increasing use of different kinds of scales and materials from other cultures, increasing influence of Latin America, more recently from Asia. And there are certainly some parallels and a great deal of influences from jazz on American popular music as a whole.
Although it has gone through different phases of popularity. At times it was the dominant popular music. At other times it was kind of hard to keep it alive. And there were periods where people said jazz is going to die simply because of lack of support. And if Japan hadn't come along, probably a lot of musicians would have starved.
Japan was very important as an outlet for music and as a source of income for American musicians. But it was associated with dancing. You know, that's originally a dance music. That's what it is. And once it stopped being that, it ran into kind of problems that all art music, so to speak, faces. Even though it still retained a kind of populist element insofar as, you know, nightclubs where jazz still is performed, you have very easy access to the artists.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll continue this conversation about the Smithsonian Folkways Jazz, the Smithsonian Anthology, with Dan Morgenstern, Director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University, John Edward Hasse, the curator of American music at the Smithsonian Institute, and Richard James Burgess, Director of Marketing and Sales at Smithsonian Folkways Recordings. We're talking about a new anthology released by Smithsonian Folkways Jazz, the Smithsonian Anthology, a 6-CD set, with John Edward Hasse, historian, pianist, author, and composer, and a man with the Smithsonian, Dan Morgenstern, director of the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University, and also Richard James Burgess, director of marketing and sales for the Smithsonian Folkways label. And we're just listening to Charlie Parker playing Embraceable You, although if you didn't know the song Embraceable You, you would not have – well, I mean, he doesn't actually play the melody of Embraceable You, and yet he called it Embraceable You. He could have called it Charlie Parker's theme or something, couldn't he?
He could have.
Yeah. He could have gotten away with that, I think. Yeah.
But what do you – in the end, so much of jazz has to do with people – creating melodies on top of other songs' chord structures. We heard Coco earlier. Many people call Duke Ellington one of the greatest composers of the 20th century. But he wrote an awful lot of songs based either on blues chord changes or on I Got Rhythm, didn't he? So is it the same as somebody composing from scratch?
Or Tiger Rag. He did about a dozen Tiger Rags, yeah, including the famous Daybreak Express. But that's a jazz tradition, you know, to use chord changes to create new pieces. Somebody invented the term contrafact for that. Yeah. But if anybody wanted to go into copyright questions, you know, God knows that would be.
it's actually a folk tradition as well, although in jazz, it's extended. But in folk music, you just usually write new lyrics and put it on an old melody.
But has that been a copyright problem over the years? Have people – I mean, the Gershwin alone, George Gershwin's estate could
Would I Got Rhythm? Well, it's hard to prove as long as the melody is not stated. Mm-hmm. But the most famous case is probably Moody's Mood for Love, which is James Moody's beautiful solo, which is another instance like Charlie Parker's Embraceable You, where the melody is never stated. But
he put words to the improvisation.
Well, yes, it was actually Eddie Jefferson, and then it was King Pleasure who recorded it with the words. But then the estate of Jimmy Mc, J, Is Jimmy McHugh? Is that the composer of I'm in the Mood for Love?
Yes, it is.
They sued and they've won. In other words, they started collecting royalties for that as well.
And then there, one of the tracks on this, track three, in fact, is Livery Stable Blues by the original Dixieland Jazz Band, recorded in 1917. There was controversy surrounding that cut when it came out.
Yes, there
was. And that was, again, a copyright issue?
And another, I think the flip side was original Dixieland.
One Step.
And there the composer of A Rag sued because the theme was used, and he won also.
So they went to
court
and—
his name. John will know his name, the composer.
J. Russell Robinson?
No, it was an African-American composer.
But it went to court, and the courts decided for the original composer.
Because they actually quoted the melody of that. It's not the very start of it. It's one of the sort of a multi-strain piece.
And then but haven't jazz improvisers done so-called musical quotes in their improvisations since the beginning of jazz?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
If they see something, a chord change that's similar to another song, they just simply throw in that quote, and audiences nod approvingly. Mm-hmm. They're amused. They caught that joke.
Mm-hmm. Right, the breaks in Louis Armstrong, 1927, he puts in a break from Rigoletto, you know, da 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 da.
Sure. So, time-honored tradition.
In his review of the anthology last Sunday, New York Times critic Ben Ratliff asserted that in order for jazz to feel like an open subject, we need more challenging suppositions about it, whether they translate as pluralistic or exclusive. What do you think he meant by that, John?
I don't know.
He used to work for me, so he worked on our show many years ago. But I wasn't sure he understood. I knew he wasn't 100% in favor of this collection.
I'm very fond of Ben, but sometimes he's hard to understand.
What do you
impenetrable.
But you knew when you put this thing together that there are going to be a lot of people who are going to snipe, complain,
of course,
feel that you made big mistakes. I know if I were going through my collection, I would choose certain tracks by musicians that would be quite different from the ones you chose. Mm-hmm. Bill Evans, God knows there are about 20 tracks that I might have chosen.
You know, you could have 1,000 different critics and experts, and there'd be 1,000 different selections. It's inevitable. But, you know, this anthology was conceived in no small measure to help undergraduate students get a feel for the breadth and scope and diversity of this music. This wasn't aimed at critics or completists, people who have thousands of jazz recordings, but in large measure for people who were looking for a broad, authoritative overview. No overview like this can be definitive, but I think we have produced something very substantial.
And Ben Ratliff praised you for not being short on facts in the accompanying essay. So this really, you saw this as an educational piece?
Basically, and that's what Martin Williams had in mind too. It was basically aimed at broadening the horizon of the hundreds of jazz history courses that are offered in colleges, which were very narrow in their perspective. And Martin did a great job in opening that up. And we hope that we have continued his tradition in that sense.
And that's one reason we decided not to have 6 or 8 tracks by any one musician, but rather limit most musicians to a single track, because we wanted to expose young people to as many different artists as we could and let them follow up on the ones that grabbed them.
And we also wanted to, or at least from my perspective, I wanted to show jazz as a living art form, a living form of culture, not an historical artifact. And we could only add one CD to the original. The original Smithsonian collection was 5 CDs, ours is 6 CDs, but we needed to add 4 decades. So we had to make some brutal decisions.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so we have jazz education in the universities, and yet I think jazz audiences are dwindling. There was a time when people would start off listening to whatever the popular music of the day was, and then at a certain point they would discover jazz and classical music, and they would move on to it. Now people in their 50s listen to the records that were popular when they were in their teens. They're still listening to that music. Mm-hmm. What do you think happened? Did jazz abandon people, or did people abandon jazz?
Well, jazz, to a large extent, was shut out of media coverage. In other words, radio, with the exception of public radio, and college radio stations, which are very jazz-oriented, just ignored the music, just like they ignored classical music. And, of course, there was the advent of rock and roll, which totally changed the picture of popular music. And jazz became sort of an esoteric pursuit. But in spite of Terry Teachout's recent, you know, dire predictions and so on, I think my colleagues would agree that jazz is very much alive. There are young musicians coming up all the time, wonderful young musicians, many of whom are in touch with the tradition. Some go off into altogether new areas, but there is a continuity. And this music is going to be, just like classical music, something that will survive, I think, for hundreds of years.
But we talked earlier about defining it. Duke said it don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. And for a long time, that would have been as good a definition as any. Or others said, well, I know it when I hear it. Improvisation has always been an important part of it. But then there are jazz recordings where there's everything is written out. So is it just kind of like, I know it when I hear it?
I think to some extent that's what we were trying to achieve with the set, because if you lay out this massively diverse set of tracks that we have and let people arrive at their own conclusions of what jazz is, because you really cannot define it. We sat down, we tried, believe me. I mean, John and I went round and round on this so many times. We made lists of terms, syncopation, swing, improvisation. You know, you go through the list and you can always find an example of another form of music.
Well, polkas swing and they are syncopated.
Yeah.
In fact, they have almost syncopated. all the qualities people improvise when they play polkas.
Absolutely. Even classical music, that's true.
Bach. The late Dick Couch, who was a wonderful pianist and very brilliant, he was also a very good writer and really a brilliant guy. He defined jazz in a very simple and compact way. He said jazz is a way of speaking music. Mm-hmm. And that's really what it is. It's a musical language. And like language, it's immensely flexible. But it's still, you know, if it's jazz, it expresses a certain kind of ambiance, I think, that runs through the whole thing, mm-hmm. whether it swings or not. It's there.
Well, that language has led a number of musicians I've spoken to talk about it as a conversation. When you're playing in a group, the musicians all listen to each other. They all kind of talk to each other musically.
No question.
And they engage in a conversation that the audience feels like it's eavesdropping on.
Well, that's the wonderful thing about jazz. It has that element of spontaneity and kind of being, you know, you're in the act, so to speak, the act of creation.
And yet a lot of people still don't get it. I know my mother used to call it doodle-oodle-oodle music. And I didn't know how to respond to that. I'd say, well, Mom, let me explain. And I'd try to go through. In the end, she shrugged. It wasn't really of interest to her. So I guess this appeals to certain people and not others.
I think that's true, yeah, and I think Dan touched on it before when he talked about swing, you know, being dance music, and you can see that at the times in jazz history when jazz has been very popular, it's often been a lot simpler. So virtuosity tends to work against it, but on the other hand, it's beautiful that people like Parker and bebop existed, and even if it wasn't popular.
You can still do it with dancing. There's a great guy named Vince Giordano, you mm-hmm. know Vince, who has a band that specializes in 1920s and early 30s music. And they play every Monday and Tuesday, you know, downstairs at the Edison Hotel in Manhattan, and people dance, you know. And the music is great because it's a recreation, but yet it allows for inventive solos and stuff, and it's very lively, and it's a throwback in a sense, but it's also very much alive.
Yeah. So how can people get this compilation?
Actually, you can get it pretty much anywhere. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it at www.folkways.si.edu.
Is it in record stores if there are still records stores?
Record stores. Yeah, whatever. It will be in record stores from the 29th of March. It's being released on the 29th of March. But you can actually buy it right now on Amazon or on our website, folkways.si.edu.
So if you want to wait to go to JNR, you have to wait till next Tuesday. Otherwise, you can go right now to the Smithsonian website.
Exactly, yeah, or Amazon.
And we're going to go out with somebody we've talked about a little bit, Miles Davis, in later in his career, because he's a perfect example of somebody who started off in one place and wound up somewhere totally different and yet is always distinctively Miles Davis. My great thanks to the three people who've been on our show today, Richard James Burgess, Director of Marketing and Sales for the Smithsonian Folkways label, Edward Hasse, and Dan Morgenstern, John Edward Hasse, I'm so sorry, and Dan Morgenstern, both historians. And John Edward Hasse is with Smithsonian. Dan Morgenstern is with the Institute of Jazz Studies at Rutgers University. Here is Miles Davis's quintet playing ESP. And thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.